Hey, I'm Ben Stiller.
I'm Adam Scott.
And we make a TV show called Severance. On January 17th, Severance is back for season 2 on Apple TV+, and we can't wait for you guys to see it.
And before the premiere, Ben and I are going to be binging season 1 and putting out daily recap podcasts.
Yep. Each weekday beginning January 7th, we'll be dropping an episode featuring exclusive behind-the-scenes tidbits and brilliant insights from our cast and crew and us.
Patricia Arquette, Britt Lauer, Zach Cherry, John Turturro, the list goes on.
All your favorite Lumen employees, their friends, families, enemies, in your feed every single weekday.
And here's the best part. After that, we're going to keep going. Tune in weekly as we recap every episode of season 2. The podcast drops on the same day the episode comes out.
It's the Severance Podcast with Ben and Adam.
On Apple Podcasts, the Odyssey app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sports Radio 93.7 The Fan, Donnie Football with you until 10:35 tonight. That is when the nightly sports call will take over. Charlie Borges is with me behind the glass. Stephen Thompson covers Pitt basketball for the Post-Gazette. He will join us in about 20 minutes time to discuss the Panthers' embarrassing loss from Monday night against Virginia, a 73-57 slog. Pitt was never in the game. They were playing a bad basketball team whose coach left them on the altar before the season. They were never in the game. They were down 15 at halftime. Virginia jumped out in front early, never looked back. Pitt never cut it down to a single-digit game. But before then, I do want to touch on the Cooper Kupp stuff a little bit just to get my two cents out there. The Rams wide receiver, he posted a message two nights ago on social media. It looked like a player that was committing or decommitting from a school or maybe entering the transfer portal. But Kupp put it out there that the Rams are open for business. And he is on the trade block. Immediately, the connections are made to the Steelers. Immediately. I don't know how many other fan bases this happens with, but it seems like almost every time a player who maybe passed the prime a little bit or a player that is going to end up somewhere else that isn't exactly highly sought after, it seems like the connections are made to the Steelers. And almost as quickly, the sports books had the Steelers as the favorites to land the former Triple Crown winner. His production is still fine. It's not elite anymore. It's fine. 710 yards, 6 touchdowns this past season on 67 catches. He will be 32 in June and is a few years removed from his historic 2021 season that saw him lead the league in receptions, yards, and touchdowns. He had 145 grabs, which, by the way, that is his only season with over 100 receptions. He had 1,947 yards. Surprisingly, he's only had one other 1,000-plus yard season. That came in 2019. And he had 16 touchdowns. He also only has one other 10-plus touchdown season. That also in 2019. That was his second-best campaign. He would have reached 1,000 yards a couple of other times. You look at what he did really in the last couple of seasons, and you can't help but think, he probably reaches 1,000 yards in some of those. But that is part of the problem here. The injuries have piled up on Cooper Kupp quite a bit. He hasn't played a full season since that 2021 campaign. 9 games in 2022, 12 games in 2023, 12 games again in 2024. The numbers he puts up every year are still pretty good, but there are other factors at hand here. The financials of the deal. The team that acquires Cooper Kupp would owe him $20 million next season, with $5 million of that being guaranteed. It would then be $19.85 million in 2026, but none of that is guaranteed, so you could get out of that deal. Now, the Rams reportedly, this coming from Ian Rappaport, have said that they will eat some of that money if it means it betters the trade offers. They'll eat some of it, not all of it. And that also would probably be a trade-off for better trade compensation going back to Los Angeles in that deal. It is also true to say that Cooper Kupp, based on the numbers that he put up last season, would have been the second best receiver in the Steelers' offense. But how much competition was there really? George Pickens, the only guy that had 900 yards, and he had that on the dot. He also missed a few games where he likely would have reached the 1,000-yard plateau. The second actual wide receiver on the team was Calvin Austin. He had 548 yards and 4 touchdowns. So yeah, Cooper Kupp, given his numbers, which I said moments ago, 710 yards, 6 touchdowns this past season, that would have been good enough for second for the Steelers receiving corps. But that says a whole lot more about the Steelers' offense and their receivers than it does about Cooper Kupp. The key cons here outweigh the pros, for me at least. That is price, and that is durability. The acquiring team in this exercise, it is the Steelers, could rework the deal a little bit, see how much money could change year by year. And again, the Rams have said they are willing to cover some of that deal. But again, that could lead to more going back to them via trade. But that's a hefty price tag right now for a wide receiver that will be 32 years old and hasn't played a full season in his last three. I think that's the most concerning part of it. I think the injuries actually make it more concerning than anything else. Plus, do we really count on the Steelers' brain trust to make his price worth it? Because I don't. I'm not sure how you could. It's difficult for me to put a lot of eggs into the basket of a 32-year-old wideout that in his final 5 games did this with a much better offense led by Sean McVay and a better quarterback in Matt Stafford. His final 5 games of the season, which includes 2 playoff games. 0 receptions, 0 yards in the 12-6 win against San Francisco. 3 receptions for 24 yards in the 19-9 win against the Jets. 1 reception, 29 yards in the 13-9 win over the Cardinals. 1 reception, 29 yards in the 27-9 wild card win against Minnesota. Kind of funny, they held three consecutive opponents to 9 points. They held four consecutive opponents under 10. Pretty impressive job by the Rams defense, if I do say so myself. And then in the final game of the season for LA, the 28-22 loss against Philly, five receptions for 61 yards. His best game by far. Add that up, do some quick math. That is 10 receptions in five games, two per game, for 143 total yards, 28.6 yards per game. An offense that has Matt Stafford, who I know is old but would still be better than the Steelers quarterbacks from last season, and a much, much, much better offensive scheme and offensive coach. I don't think it makes a ton of sense to bring in Cooper Kupp given the money and the age. And also what the Steelers have to offer from an offensive standpoint. 412-928-9370. We'll have Stephen Thompson join us in about 10 minutes' time. Charlie, something else I wanted to get into with you. You texted me about this the other night because I sent you something that I got recently. My third one of these that I have. I have acquired my third, what I will call a movie athlete jersey. I got this of all places on the TikTok shop. It was a flash sale a couple of Sundays ago. Not this past Sunday, the one before. The jersey was like $16. Sarah has used the TikTok shop before. She said, well, it's cheap. It looks like it'd be pretty good quality. It comes in, sure enough, it is pretty good quality. It's better than most of the jerseys I have purchased from China over the last decade, since those are always hit or miss. Had a nice little patch on it that is from the movie. I got a Bobby Boucher jersey from The Waterboy.
I love it.
And it actually looks good. I sent you a picture of it. That gave you the idea. What are the best fake athlete jerseys that you could have? I have two other ones.
I only have one.
The two other ones I have are baseball related.
What would those be?
I have the Wild Thing, Rick Vaughn.
Love it.
And then I have Coop Cooper from basketball.
That took me a second. I love it. I only have a Charlie Conway Mighty Ducks jersey, which seems to be a popular fake jersey to have nowadays. That's the only fictional sport character jersey I have. And then I texted you one that I want, and you said that you had the same idea, and that would be Shane Falco.
Yes. Yeah, that would be a good one to have.
Washington Sentinel fame.
You have Shane Falco. You have Battle X from The Longest Yard. Forrest Gump. Maybe you want to get a Forrest Gump jersey. I had a Bad News Bears jersey as a kid that I wore in like elementary school. The other one that I always think of, this isn't a fake athlete, it's a real guy, but it is the wrong number in the movie. Boobie Miles, Permian Panthers.
Great. That's also a good one.
But he wasn't actually number 45. He was number 35 in real life.
Why'd they change it?
I don't know. I never really looked into that. I love that movie. It's my favorite football movie. I know there's plenty of inaccuracies. I know there's plenty of things to, you know, kind of pick it apart when it comes to a true story standpoint. Same goes for Remember the Titans, by the way. But he was number 35. Chris Comer was number 45.
So they flipped it.
Who was the backup in the movie? Comer was number 42 in the movie. Boobie Miles was number 45. Dawn Billingsley was number 26. I think that is accurate. I also think that Mike Winchell was actually number 20.
Which is a weird quarterback number.
Look up the real guy. And then, who is it, Lucas Black that played Mike Winchell? Look up a side-by-side of those two. They nailed that casting job. It's identical.
By the way, there is a Famico jersey, also from The Replacements, the sumo wrestler. There's a jersey. Jumbo. There's a jersey of his that I'm looking at right now.
That would be a pretty good one.
Especially like somebody like you who loves big offensive linemen. That'd be perfect.
Somebody just texted in a good one. This is a great one. Al Bundy. Polkai, number 33. Yep. That's a great one. I mean, if you're a fan of Space Jam, I don't know. Get one of those ones, maybe. I never was. I've seen people that have, like, the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Yeah, I've also seen
basketball jerseys.
One Tree Hill. The Ravens.
I never watched that show. Sorry to disappoint
you.
What about G-Baby?
Oh, R.I.P. G-Baby. Spoiler alert if you haven't seen the movie, but if you haven't seen it by now, it's 25 years old. It's 25 years old, by the way. Ask Sarah if she's ever watched One Tree Hill. I bet she has. I just had it and I lost it. Oh, that's going to bug me now. Oh, Flint Tropics.
Oh, Jackie Moon.
Yeah, Jackie Moon jersey.
I knew a kid in college who had a Jackie Moon. That was always like a good... There was that era in college. I don't know if it's when every kid is in college or if it was just the era that we went to school in. But it was always big to wear like a jersey to a party.
Yes. We had...
Like you make a statement as like a dude in his late teens, early 20s, maybe not even legally allowed to drink alcohol yet. And you just roll into a party with some random jersey on.
There were a few jersey parties at Westminster. I remember there was one guy. I never saw him again. He had a Oklahoma Adrian Peterson jersey. He walked in.
That's a good one.
I was like, I was of age and I was a little tuned up and I freaked out. I was like, oh, that's the best jersey I've seen tonight. And I never saw the dude again. So I don't know if he was visiting and he knew that there was a jersey party, but I never saw him again. So if you're out there, and you have an Adrian Peterson Oklahoma jersey. Kudos to you. But he's an actually real person.
It's kind of rare to go to a school of that size and never see the dude again.
Exactly. So I think he may have been just visiting.
I can't think of many Waynesburg people. Maybe I didn't know their name, but I certainly knew their faces, and I saw them several times.
Was Waynesburg the type of school where if you did something stupid at a party at 8 o'clock... And if you went somewhere at 9 o'clock, everybody on campus knew what you did at 8 o'clock?
Small enough school to at least get some word around, I would say. Yeah.
Similar experiences. I never did anything that dumb that would travel campus-wide. There were a few things that did.
Listen to the Joe Starkey Show every Wednesday to hear about Starkey's Card of the Week from the Baseball Card Castle in Cranberry. Contests run every Wednesday through Friday at 12 noon. At the 93.7thefan.com contesting page. Donnie Football with you on 93.7 The Fan until 10:35, so about another hour with me. Just had a discussion about the best fake athlete jerseys, and there are some really good suggestions on the text line that we will get to in a little bit. But right now we go back out to that fan hotline, And we welcome in Stephen Thompson, who covers Pitt Athletics for the Post-Gazette. Stephen, do you own any fake athlete jerseys? For example, a Bobby Boucher, maybe a Rick Vaughn, Cleveland Indians from the movie Major League, something of that nature?
You know, I think the closest thing I have is a Bel Air Academy jersey. I believe I have, you know, I'm really embarrassing myself. What is Will Smith's character, name? My friend and I from high school.
I think it's just his name, isn't it?
Yeah, whatever. I mean, I'll have to dig it up at some point when we're done with this segment. But yeah,
I think it is just Will Smith.
Yeah, no. So my friend from high school, we were Bel Air Academy and Carlton. We were Will Smith and Carlton. That was our costume for that year. I think it was my junior year. Oh, you know what it was? No, we ordered them off of DHgate, and they didn't show up until about 2 months after Halloween. So we didn't end up getting to be them. But yeah. That was our idea, and we didn't end up getting to execute it.
Yeah, that tends to happen with DHgate, which, based on how some things are going right now, I don't know how much longer DHgate has, but it had a hell of a run, old DHgate did. Stephen, a miserable loss for Pitt the other night. Virginia comes in here, a bad basketball team. Coach left them right before the season started. They're below 500. They still are. They ran away from Pitt. The Panthers were never in this game. What were some of your takeaways from that 73-57 loss?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing for me was the defense. It looked like Virginia, I'll say out-schemed them, but I think a lot of it was also, communication as well on the floor for Pitt. You watch that game back, and the number of times that Pitt just had to run through screens, but didn't communicate well enough to know, all right, my teammate's getting screened here, I got to be here, I get to help them out. But also just kind of the effort of getting over or underneath these screens to get connected to a three-point shooter. Virginia's a pretty good three-point shooting team. That's really most of the extent of what they do really well offensively, and Pitt was just not able to get out to the shooters on defense. And then, Virginia's also the worst offensive rebounding team in the conference, full stop. And Pitt was giving up offensive rebounds and second chance points left and right to them. So I think that's where, when we talked to Jeff Cable and, one of their players after the game, they called out their own effort. And I think that's where it shows up. You can explain away when Duke or some of these other teams that are really good at offensive rebounding relative to the rest of the conference are beating you for second chance points and things like that. But with Virginia, who statistically is the worst team in the conference at offensive rebounding, and they're beating you for things like that, that's when you really start to get concerned about the product that Pitt is putting on the floor. So I think the defense, the offense has its own concerns, but it's been kind of well documented over the past few weeks. They don't move the ball very well. They don't create a ton of open shots, and they don't hit those open shots when they do come. But the defense, I think, was the biggest concern to me.
Yeah, I mean, Pitt doesn't have a ton of what I would say bad losses. I mean, before the other night, that blowout loss at Mississippi State is ugly. I mean, they lost the game by over 30 points. The Duke game got ugly by the end, but Duke's one of the best teams in the country, so a road loss there isn't the end of the world. Otherwise, some close losses, overtime loss to Clemson. They lose by 2 points on Saturday against Wake Forest. They come back Monday, and we're thinking, okay, they'll be able to get, right back on it. They're playing a bad team. That should set them up well down the stretch. They pick up win number 15. Then they go to UNC. They go to SMU. And now all of that seems to be in question. And you brought up the effort from the game the other night, Stephen. And I'll be honest, I watched the first half of the game. I was pretty disgusted at that point. They were down by 15. They were never in it. I didn't watch the game in the second half, but based on what I saw in the first half, I would agree with what the players called themselves out on. The effort was pretty poor. It just seemed like they were disorganized and disinterested.
Yeah, and, you know, it's something that at different points this season we've seen them give what I would call poor effort in certain areas, whether it was defensively or rebounding, or, you know, you could think about the end of that Clemson game. I didn't think their offense was very good, and, you know, the off-ball movement and things of that nature. There were areas where I thought the effort was bad, but I didn't think their total effort was bad. Against Virginia, it was a completely bad team effort there. And something that I don't know if you can necessarily – that's just something that shouldn't happen, you know, for a team that had, you know, lost. I believe it was 5 of 7 at that point, even though they were on, you know, a stretch where they had gotten a couple wins after that 4-game losing streak. I mean, that just shouldn't happen for a team, you know, of Pitt's level of talent and with this level of expectations. I think that was really the most disappointing thing, was that in all phases of the game, the effort was bad. It's not something that, you know, even if you thought that watching the game, it's not something that Jeff Capel or any of the players had kind of called out amongst themselves. When it's that obvious to the coaches and the players, I think that's when you really start to get concerned. And so, you know, you can look at that 4-game losing streak they had a while ago, that loss to Wake Forest. I mean, you can explain those away a little bit. They lost, for the most part, to good teams, and for the most part in kind of close fashion. But this was a blowout loss to a bad team, in which you can easily say that Pitt was not working hard enough to get that win. And I think that's the most damning part of the entire night. You'll have nights where the shots don't fall. You have nights where you're just off and when things aren't working, but when it's so easy to say that the effort was bad, that's when you really start to get concerned. That's when you start to say, well, you know, where is this going to get corrected down the road? Because that's something internal. That's something the players have to fix themselves. That's not really something that you can necessarily scheme against or prepare for is a bad effort from your own team.
What do you think Pitt's biggest problem is right now?
That's a great question. You know, I mentioned the communication on defense, but honestly, I think their defense has mostly been pretty good. I think the thing that I'm most concerned about is, you know, the play of their best player. You know, Jalen Lowe played really well to start the season, and I think he's a really good player. But I think especially over last month or so, really since the beginning of the new year, I think he, along with Ish Leggett, were kind of pressing the score a little bit too much. It's something that we've talked to Jeff Capel about. It's something that the players themselves have acknowledged. And I'll give Leggett a lot of credit. There were some moments, I think especially that Duke game, where he was pressing a lot to put the ball in the basket, putting his head down and maybe getting a little bit of tunnel vision, excuse me. But then came out the next game and had, you know, a couple games in a row with 3 or 4 assists, where he was clearly looking to get off the ball and, you know, create some movement for Pitt on offense. I think Lowe can do a little bit better in that department as well. He's a really great passer that I think is looking to score a little bit too much and score on his own a little bit too much. So I think Pitt needs its two best players, Jalen Lowe and Ish Leggett, who didn't have Leggett played pretty well against Virginia, but, you know, on the whole, I think during this, you know, skid since, you know, that Duke game really a month or so ago, they need them to be better playmakers, to initiate this offense a little bit better, and to create more movement and just make this offense a little more lively and a little less individual and one-on-one. I think that's a really great way for Pitt to kind of get back on track. I think the defense is going to figure itself out. I think Virginia was in a naturally bad game and an easy way to the problems in the Virginia game on defense were easy to figure out. The offense, I think it's got to come from their two best players playing a little bit better and playing a little bit more connected to the rest of their teammates.
Talking to Stephen Thompson, a Pitt reporter from the Post Gazette, Conte played 15 minutes the other night, but we have seen the minutes diminish for Conte and Cummings as this season has gone on. What is up there? Is it just that Jeff Capel doesn't feel that they are fitting into his mix? Because their minutes were up earlier in the season, and you know they didn't play all that poorly.
Yeah, so Papa Conte, I think, is a little bit easier to explain. I mean, he gave him some energy off the bench, especially against Virginia, and I think about that Ohio State game as well. He gave him some energy. But there were also moments, especially against Virginia, where he, you know, looked a little lost on defense, maybe didn't exactly know where everyone was going to be on offense. I think he still has a little bit of a ways to go in terms of learning the system on both ends of the court. And that's not to say that he's a bad player or anything like that, or that he's not trying, or that he doesn't have his nose in the playbook at all. I just think it takes time. You know, he is essentially a freshman. You know, he had all of last year off with a knee injury. So this is really his first year of Division I college basketball, and I think he's just taken some time to get up to speed. Cummings is a little bit more interesting. You're right, I thought he played really well during the non-conference slate and even had, that Cal game early in ACC play where he played really well and was able to kind of take on some responsibilities as a ball handler that were really good, and he had some really good minutes in that sense as well. You know, Jeff Capel has kind of spoken broadly about the fact that, you know, if you want to play off the bench, you need to be in tune with everything that we're doing, offense and defense. You can't just be an offense or defense player. You have to be, to understand what we're doing on both ends of the court, and you have to be ready to do that, all the time. So reading between the lines a little bit, I suspect that Cummings is kind of in the same boat where, you know, he just maybe isn't ready, doesn't have the complete understanding of what Pitt wants to do on both ends of the court for Jeff Capel to feel comfortable putting him in an ACC game, especially at this point in the season where things are tightening up a little bit. The pressure's on a little bit. The games are much more important. He can't allow necessarily freshmen to work through their mistakes on the court without consequence at this point in the season. So I without super intimate knowledge of the situation, that would be my guess. I can't tell you why Cummings isn't at least gotten a little bit more of a look, you know, excluding foul trouble, which was most of the reason why he got into that Virginia game. I think he has certainly earned a little bit more leeway, at least in terms of just because he's a really good shooter. He can score a little bit off the bounce, and he's a competitive defender too. Like, you never worry that effort is going to be a problem with Brandon Cummings. So I wouldn't be shocked if he gets some more run against UNC, which is a team that doesn't kind of pose the same size problems that a Duke or even a Clemson or a Florida State would pose, where he didn't get many minutes in those games. Teams could easily exploit him in that way because he's a little bit shorter. I think UNC could be a really good opportunity, especially at this moment where you might be worried about, you know, the overall team effort. I think Brandon could give you a great spark. I would expect to see a few minutes from him on Saturday afternoon when they go down to Chapel Hill.
Before we get to that game by itself, how do you feel about the prospect of Pitt's tournament chances after the loss against Virginia? I know that Joe Lunardi from ESPN, he currently has them as part of the first four out, which they are with two other ACC teams, Wake Forest and SMU, as part of the first four out.
Yeah, the good news is that they still have, I think it's four quad one opportunities left, starting with that game down in North Carolina on Saturday afternoon. So I think at a lot of points this season, people have underestimated just how strong Pitt's resume is. That win against West Virginia, the win against Ohio State. Also how competitive they were against Wisconsin. That stuff matters. So they are far from, you know, completely out of the tournament just yet. But it's going to take some work for them to get off of, you know, that first four out that Lunardi has them in and back into the field relatively solidly. That's the thing. Pitt was, you know, up until I would say maybe that Florida State loss, they were very solidly in the field. I mean, even up until that Virginia loss, they had upwards of, I would say, 60% odds of making the NCAA tournament. So they haven't fallen as far, I think, as it might feel. But you're going to have to win. Whereas, you know, if you didn't lose to Virginia, maybe you only had to win one of, you know, these three big remaining games against UNC, SMU, and Louisville. You probably have to win two of those. And your two easiest opportunities are Saturday against UNC and then Tuesday on the road against SMU. So going into the ACC tournament at the end of the year, it's going to be hard to feel like Pitt is very solidly in. But at the very least, you have to take care of business and steal one or two off of, like I said, UNC, SMU, and Louisville down the stretch here.
An 8-point win the last time the Panthers played at North Carolina, not that long ago, a little bit over a week ago, late January, 73-65, Pitt winning that game at home. How do you feel this time with Pitt on the road against UNC on Saturday?
A little less certain, I would say. You know, I was pretty confident that they would beat UNC going into that game at home. But, you know, North Carolina's going to have Jalen Washington back, who's their starting center, probably their best front court player. He's expected to play. And Pitt, you know, was able to, you know, Cam Corn had a pretty decent game against Florida State. That's not going to be as easy for him to put up the numbers that he did against UNC. And then also it's going to be a pretty intimidating environment in the Dean Dome. I think going down into a place like that is always tougher than playing a team like North Carolina at home. That said, Pitt has had some really good recent success against North Carolina. Last year, North Carolina was one of the elite teams in the country, and Pitt still, you know, played them very competitively, especially in the ACC tournament. I think Jeff Cable knows how to coach against this team. And Pitt knows how to play against this team, but it's all going to come down to the defense. If they can improve the defense, if they take some pride individually in defending one-on-one, which is really what won them that game at the Peterson Event Center not too long ago. That's the key to victory. It's all going to start on defense. It's going to start individually. Start with Pitt kind of taking some pride in their one-on-one matchups and being able to defend, especially out on the perimeter. So if you made me make a prediction right now, I think Pitt wins, but I'm certainly not as confident as I was going into that game at the Peterson Event Center not too long ago.
Stephen Thompson covers Pitt for the Post-Gazette. Stephen, thanks for hopping on and taking the time, man.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
There we go. Stephen Thompson from the PG predicting a close Pitt win on Saturday. 4 o'clock, you can listen to that game right here on 93.7 The Fan. Pre-game coverage at 3:30. Fan Twitter at 93.7 The Fan. That's brought to you by South Hills Kia in Peters Township. Visit them at southhillskia.net. Coming up, a couple of good submissions on the text line, Charlie, about the jersey discussion that we were just having. And my friend, we will also give a little review of the Royal Rumble, which was this past Saturday.
Still got a lot to do. So little time.
Like Willy Wonka said.
He said that?
So much time, so little to do.
I thought he said,
scratch that, reverse it.
Thought he said, oh, look at you. You can walk again.
And then he played that little flute.
Oh, Gene
Wilder. I always liked when that happened.
What a man, Gene Wilder.
Well, Charlie, some baseball breaking news. You and Greg Finley next door, you guys can hug and kiss.
I'm going to go tell him right now.
Until home. This is coming down from Jeff Pass and Pete Alonso and the New York Mets in agreement on a contract. So the right-handed slugger going back to Queens. We will see what the financials are there. Yeah, I mean, the Pirates weren't going to sign him, but I knew that that would make Charlie quite excited.
I'm good with that. Sorry, I just had to go. I had to tell Finley. He had no idea.
2 years includes an opt-out after the first season. $30 million this year. Those are the financials on the deal. Feeling pretty good about those Mets?
I would still like another bullpen arm and maybe another bench option.
They're going to need about everything they can possibly get to beat the Dodgers.
I'd agree.
When it comes to crunch time.
But what's more important? The Pete Alonso going back to the Mets or Marcus Patterson agreeing to a massive extension with the Vancouver Canucks?
Well, we know what makes you more excited, and we know what in general makes people more excited. It's the Pete Alonso news.
Finley just came in here and he's celebrating. So, I mean, it's exciting. Yeah, that's a, I don't want to, like, I feel bad. Like, I feel like I'm rubbing it in. Because we just, we spent a half an hour with Noah Hyles, and you're like, what about Kevin Pillar? What about, why couldn't we get Randall Grichuk? And the Mets are like, yeah, Pete, you want $30 million a year? Here you go.
Nah, the Mets won't, they won't get past the big dogs anyway. And then you'll be disappointed.
Hey, at least we're in it. Anything can happen in baseball.
I guess. I mean, the Diamondbacks got to the World Series a couple of years ago. But, man, I haven't seen as much a one-sided free agency period as I have in that in quite some time than I have seen this year from the Dodgers.
I think my favorite thing about that whole...
The Mets got Soto. They brought back a guy they already had with Alonso.
Yeah, and their bullpen, or not their bullpen, their starting pitcher acquisitions were Reese bringing a guy back and Frankie Montas. That's really about it.
Like, I mean, when it comes to pitching, that is where I feel bad for you because the Pirates have better starting pitching than the Mets.
Well, Paul Skeens would be... I think Paul Skeens would be the number one on probably at least 25 of the 30 teams in Major League Baseball.
Yeah, that's true. I think I would take the Pirates top three over the Mets top three, though.
Skeens, Jones, and Keller?
Yeah.
So you're doing that against... Well, who's going to be the number one?
Probably start there. Yeah, the Mets probably should have focused a little bit more there.
Hold on.
Because that could be what gets you past a team like the Dodgers.
So, you got Kodai Senga, who's okay. Yeah. Yeah, I you know, Mr. Football? May have to start calling you Donnie Baseball. Kodai Senga, David Peterson, Shawn Manaea, who had a bad first half but changed everything and became one of the best pitchers in baseball. Frankie Montas, yeah.
You still have Jose Quintana?
No, he was the largest. No, he's a free agent. I thought you meant Luis Severino. We don't have Quintana anymore.
Yeah, I know Severino went to the A's.
Largest deal in franchise history was Luis Severino.
But some of these...
No, go ahead.
Sure. Well, I was going to change the subject. I didn't know how much...
It's okay. We can stop talking about the Mets. Sorry.
Just wait. Middle of June, they'll have the same record.
Only one way to find out.
Some of these jersey suggestions, we did miss some good ones. I know we mentioned the Al Bundy number 33 Polkai. Couple of Happy Gilmore suggestions. See, Gilmore, he wore that Bruins sweater, but in the movie he didn't have anything on the back. He just kind of wore a Bruins sweater. He wore a home and away, a black and a white one.
Yeah, it's cool, but it wasn't his jersey. Like the other suggestions you're looking at are above and beyond.
Yeah, we got Willie Beeman from Any Given Sunday. Hot take about that movie. I don't really care for it.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
They went with some star power with former players and, Jamie Foxx, Al Pacino. The Al Pacino speech is fantastic.
Yeah. Top five?
But otherwise.
In sports movies?
Top five speech?
Yeah.
Probably. But I watched it, I think, during COVID. It took me a while to get around to that movie and watch it in full. It disappointed me. I thought I thought the actual football scenes were pretty ridiculous. and goofy, almost cartoonish.
Yeah, that'll happen in movies.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I feel like there are football movies where, you know, you obviously can't replicate it, but it at least looks more realistic than what you watch in that movie.
The better viewing experience, that or Air Bud?
I'm not watching Air Bud.
You wouldn't get an Air Bud jersey with K9 on the back?
No, I don't. I will take any given Sunday, literally any given Sunday over that, or any other day of the week for that matter. But Friday Night Lights, Replacements.
Did you watch the Friday Night Lights show?
I watched the first few seasons of it. They kind of just combined like multiple football movies into one.
Yeah.
And I thought the like high school drama was a little bit ridiculous for me. I mean, like, Riggins was just like a criminal who never even went to school, and this guy's just showing up on Friday nights and he's playing football.
True. I never knew what like year they were in either. That was never really specified.
The movie's significantly better. Like, I won't listen to anybody who says they take the show.
A couple of the same actors, too, right? I think the wife.
Buddy Garrity.
Yep, the Buddy Garrity and the wife.
The wife, yes. Maybe somebody else mixed in there. But back to Any Given Sunday, I would take Friday Night Lights. I would take Remember the Titans. I would take, Replacements. I would take Varsity Blues, no doubt. A couple of suggestions there for Varsity Blues. Billy Bob, Tweeter.
Can't believe I didn't think
of R.I.P. Billy Bob. And R.I.P. to Paul Walker. Lance Harbor.
Wow.
James Vanderbeek.
Yeah.
John Moxon.
What was...
Another football movie I would take over Any Given Sunday. All the Right Moves. Tom Cruise, Craig T. Nelson. You ever see that one? Filmed around here, Charlie.
I don't think I have. The program's pretty good. It's one of Jay's, was one of Mackey's favorites.
Another one.
Underrated.
Yeah. But yeah, that's a hot take of mine when it comes to football movies that I didn't really care for Any Given Sunday. I like the twist at the end, and I love the Al Pacino speech. Longest Yard.
Mm.
I'll take that one. I'll take The Water Boy.
Billy Bob's real name was Ron Lester.
Yes.
So R.I.P. to...
He lost a ton of weight, and then he passed away.
Yeah. I believe he played a spoof of himself in Not Another Teen
and
Movie.
And what was his name?
I think it was Billy Bob.
It was Reggie Ray.
Oh, Reggie Ray.
Yep. They got to get back to like the great spoof movies that they once had.
If I remember correctly, his character was the offensive lineman that had five more concussions. Otherwise, the blood clot in his brain, the size of a grapefruit, was going to burst.
They had part of the scoreboard counting his concussions. Billy Bob is a great character. And man, what was John Voight in Varsity Blues? Was that guy a real piece of work?
He knows how to play a bad guy.
Man.
So, like, it has to be based off of somebody. Like, I don't know.
Maybe like Bear Bryant. I don't know. I mean, yeah, I'm sure there were plenty of hard-ass coaches that were playing in Texas high school football. But yeah, he really did sell the bad guy thing well. Something very funny about that movie too. The man just did not have any assistant coaches.
Yeah. So when
he leaves during the final game, and he's gone, and the guys coaching the team are Paul Walker and the running back that got hurt. Wendell was his name in the movie. I don't know who the actor is.
No, not Wendell Clark. Was it Clark?
I don't know about that. He had that full ride to Grambling.
Yep.
But yeah, it's those two
Wendell
guys.
Brown.
It's those two guys coaching up the team, and Bud Kilmer's just walking down the halls. He's packing up his office. They didn't move the statue, though.
Oh, I didn't know.
Do you remember why?
I'm sorry, I was looking at the guy who played Wendell, who was a nationally ranked high school player, went to Stanford, was an undrafted free agent for the Kansas City Chiefs, and his days were cut short by an injury.
How about that?
Art imitates life.
How old was he in the movie?
Ooh,
that's so always good when you see like the ages of guys that played high schoolers.
So he was born in 70, or he was born in 75.
Okay, he would have been movie, he would have been like 24 in that movie.
Yeah, roughly, like 24 or 25. So he would have, at that point, had just gotten done with his run with the Chiefs.
Yeah. I remember the guy that played Booby Miles in the movie was like 30 years old.
Derek Luke.
Yeah, he's been in a handful of things. Yeah, he was. I always like looking at that. People give the one guy from Grease a hard time.
John Travolta?
No, Sonny.
How old was Sonny?
I think he was like 32. He wasn't even the oldest one in the movie. There were like two or three others that were just as old, if not older. But you see that all the time. Like, you see high schoolers that they're portrayed by people that are like my age, our age.
Wow. That's a connection that I never knew.
What's this fun fact?
Jesse Plemons played the little brother.
Yes, he was in the little brother, and then he was in the show Friday Night Lights.
There you go.
Yeah.
So he has a little connection between two high school football shows.
How about the Little Giants?
Oh, Icebox. That'd be the jersey I would wear.
Spike Hammersmith.
Yeah.
You know who else is in those movies? The guy that is in all of the Final Destinations, or a lot of them.
Devin Sawa. Yep.
Yeah.
He was only in the first one.
Oh, he is? I thought he was in a couple of them.
No, he was only in the first one. Okay. Now we're really getting into it, because I'm a horror buff. He was in the first one. He made a quote-unquote cameo. There was just a picture of a dead body that they said it was him in the second one. And all these movies are like decades old, so if you've missed them, I'm sorry for spoiling them. And then
I mean, pretty much everybody dies. It's Final Destination. And they have the most ridiculous deaths of all time.
Yeah. And then the fifth one that came out, the end twist was that it was actually a prequel to the first one. So he made a cameo in the fifth one as well. So like the people who avoided death in the fifth one caused the events of the first movie. So while they were on the plane, Devin Sawa's character freaks out, which kicks off the first movie.
Yes, it does.
But the people that were in the fifth movie were like, oh, well, we've been through this and we know we're going to die. And the sixth one, in the trailer just released like yesterday, and it looks...
Bloodlines. You think they're going to have Roman Reigns in that movie?
Yeah, at least got to have a Jacob Fatu appearance.
He just murks somebody. And Paul Heyman is just in the corner.